Perimeter Institute for this. Okay, so this will be this talk will necessarily have some overlap with some prior talks, even though at least Fernando and to some extent Chris and I tried to do some coordination, of course, with late night yesterday final preparation of slides. There is no full coordination. Okay, so so I will talk, of course, about the additivity conjectures and relations to the asymptotic geometric analysis. And I will try to, well, first just go very, very briefly over, just flash the slides about notation and stuff like that, because since it was covered already maybe twice. Then I will say a little bit more about the case of Pirenne entropy. This hasn't been addressed, and it's particularly nicely connected with the geometric function analysis and Dvoretsky's theorem. Then I will say a little bit more about Dvoretsky's theorem and some fine points. Okay, so then I will go back to that counterexample, and then I will try to say something about the Hastings counterexample in the same framework. And finally, I will talk a little bit to what Fernando hinted, the bounding concentration using chaining. Okay? So that's maybe Kolmogorov. There were, of course, a number of names that were in between Kolmogorov and the proof of Dvoretsky's theorem by chaining. But okay. So anyway, so this is just a quick flash of the notation. Now, what is important here is I'm going to use D for states, which maybe it's reasonably standard, but perhaps not absolutely standard. And then I like to have this picture here, which is the following, that you have, okay, where is the stick? Which way should I am supposed to hold it? Okay, so this is the positive semi-definite cone, intersection with trace line hyperplane. That's in the Hermitian matrices. That gives us this set of mixed states, and the extreme points of which are few states. Okay, then when you take a symmetric reflection of the set of states and take the convex hull, then you get the unit ball in the trace class norm. And that unit ball has extreme points plus minus few states. So in this Hermitian part of the trace class norm. So this is the picture I like to show. And then in particular, what follows that for very many parameters, the extreme points are pure states or plus minus pure states. So that's where the action is for that. Now, next thing is quantum channels. So those are the objects in quantum information. Right, and here are morphies, which are, depending on what one talks about, quantum operations of channels. So mathematically, those are completely positive trace-preserving map, usually, or maybe trace non-increasing. But and then we have this equivalence. So I don't define this already. We have this equivalence. There is this Krafts representation and Stein's representation. And actually, for the purpose of this talk, it's enough to restrict the attention to this representation, which means that you have this, I will try to keep always the same letters. The input will be M, which maybe is not very good because, no, okay, it doesn't matter. G will be the output, and K will be environment or whatever. So in this case, so you have an isometry. So basically, this is everything where the talk starts. You have an isometry from CM to the tensor product space CD tensor CK, and then you sort of conjugate your state with that isometry and take the partial trace with respect to the second system, which I will write as trace 2. Okay, so that's, everybody has seen that, and that, of course, it's just rephrasing of the Krafts representation and so forth. So basically, again, we'll be working with this representation. Okay. So basically, this is the crucial insight, which is that basically with every quantum channel, one can associate a subspace. So when channel goes CM to CD, then for some k, which is actually not too large and depends on the rank of this Krauss representation or whatever, but certainly not more than square of this, I think smaller of the two indices or whatever. Then there is a subspace. Okay, so with every channel, you can associate a subspace, and certainly vice versa, because vice versa just gives you the formula, right, which was on the previous slide. So channels are really subspaces. And actually, the exact isometry is not really that important, because it just really corresponds to choosing a basis in that subspace. And all the reasonable parameters depend only on the subspace. So this I've actually heard for the first time about a year ago in fields, in the talk by Chris King, and that was to me illumination, because then I realized it's subspaces. That's something we understand in functional analysis. Okay, so, but actually it goes even farther. So this is what I just have said. And actually, one may sort of, and I'm going to not to strictly insist on distinguishing the range of V with which is this W with CM itself, because one could think of phi as acting from the algebra V of W to V of CD, and then the channel is just trace, just partial trace. So in a way, this is sort of inessential. Now this was already pointed out, even though not maybe stated absolutely explicitly today, that whenever we have a pure state, which is a vector in this tensor product, Hilbert space, then you can tell very easily what the shape of the image is under our channel if you look at the Schmidt decomposition of that vector. So Schmidt decomposition is you write it in that form where those are supposed to be orthonormal sequences in each of the factors, and SJs are, or maybe squares of SJs are Schmidt decompositions, but in any case, this is the formula. So once you know what the Schmidt coefficients of your pure state are, you know what the image is. Well, of course you know, but it's a very simple encoding. And I have a slide with verification. So how do you verify that? Well, you just write what phi is, then you expand it, and then use the fact that those are orthonormal, so you get delta function, and that will prove. So those are orthonormal sequences in the respective factors. Now, there is, this is a recapitulation of the problem really in linear algebra terms, sort of almost on the undergraduate level. Well, actually, not almost, yes. So what do we have? We have every channel is associated to a subspace of that tensor product space, which in turn can be canonically, more or less, associated just with a space of matrices, V by K matrices, which are just operators between two spaces. So the association is not maybe absolutely perfect because not linear. It's not linear. It's antilinear in the second variable. But that's a technicality which can be somehow handled by putting adjoints in right places. I won't worry about this. Whenever you have a unit vector in this tensor product space, so that corresponds to a matrix with the Hilbert-Schmidt or Schatten 2 norm equal to 1. And Schmidt decomposition is just really a different name to the singular value decomposition, which of course one learns in the first linear algebra course. Okay? So basically, and then the output actually, one can essentially forget about this partial trace, because if one looks closely, then this is just this product of the matrix here by its adjoint, and it lives in the proper space. So basically, all references to channels, partial trace, one can forget. We have a subspace. Then in the set of matrices, then you are looking at singular value decompositions at matrices in the subspace, and that's what you want to look at. So what is the bottom line? You have a subspace, you have an m-dimensional subspace W of d by k matrices, and then you want to understand what the patterns of singular numbers of that matrix are as the matrix varies over the subspace. And that's the whole question. It's something that can be completely understood in. Okay, so now this goes even farther. So what are the DDB conjectures. So these are just definitions. So it's attained in a few states, so that's what I said, that's where the action is. Those definitions were given. And then the conjecture for the minimal output entropy, which was answered, that's the year for the publication, it was 1 year earlier. The result, right? So now the another problem is on Renyi entropy, so that all appeared on Chris's slide, I believe, and the raison d'etre for the, well, in a way for the entropy was that as p goes to 1, 1 retrieves the von Neumann entropy, and so everything that you, if you can prove nice things about the Pirani entropy, then you can also prove things about the von Neumann entropy in some cases. However, now those are just factors for normalization, so that you get the thing in the limit. But when you look it closely enough to logarithmic change of variable and a coefficient, this is really the Schottenpy norm. Well, the pth root doesn't matter because it just enters into a constant after the logarithm, right? So that's what it is. So basically, what we are looking is here working at the minimum, we are really looking at the maximum. So I'm sort of, well, this was of course very well known already 10 years ago or so. You are looking at the maximum over all states, which is the same as maximum over all few states. And since those are extreme points, or plus minus are extreme points of the unit ball, then this is really a map, the norm of that map as an operator from the trace class to the Schottenpy class. And now, since we are making this logarithmic change of variables, so additivity of the translates to multiplicativity, and then the min-max switches because we have a negative coefficient. Right? So that's okay. So anyway, so to recapitulate, we have a question about multiplicativity of this of the norm from 1 to p. So let's focus on that and let's see what that means, and that will be even more natural from the functionalities point of view. Because, so first of all, of course, it's an operator norm. This is a natural object. But now when you look at this, then remember that the output for a state which is related to the matrix A, the rectangular matrix A, which corresponds to a pure state, is the pth norm of A conjugate, a dagger, which is just 2-piece norm of A itself squared. Right, so well, there's no surprise because we are, well, those are, this is everything expressed in terms of singular values of the original matrix A. Okay, so in other words, the square root of that norm, because of that square here, square root of that norm is the maximum over this subspace W, well, zero you have to remove, not to divide by zero, of this ratio between those two norms, the two-piece norm and the second norm, Hilbert-Schmidt norm. Now, p is arbitrary, well, actually, well, let's say greater than 2, so that p is greater than 1, so 2p is greater than 2. So we have the q's norm, where q is greater than 2 and divided by 2 norm. So now this is of course, once one sees something like that in geometric function analysis, one thinks about Dvoretsky theorem, because that's exactly comparing arbitrary norm with Euclidean norm, that's exactly what Dvoretsky's theorem is about. So now, what is Dvoretsky's theorem? Well, before I tell you, there is a commercial interruption. So, well, if you have a time, I unfortunately don't have pictures, right? So there is, if you have time in the first week of August, there may be interesting things there, so either go there or may talk to me. Okay? So now what Dvoretsky theorem is? Dvoretsky theorem tells that if you have a high dimensional, very high dimensional convex bodies, well, high dimensional phenomena and stuff, then they have almost spherical sections of fairly large dimension. So of course, not as large as this dimension becomes large, this dimension also becomes large, goes to infinity. Okay. Now, the more precise statement is the following, that if you have a number m and epsilon, now m is the dimension of the subspace and epsilon is the distortion, then there is a capital N which depends only on those two, and so that for every norm on a real or a complex Euclidean space, so this norm is general, right, for any norm, there is an m-dimensional subspace on which those norms are approximately proportional up to certain factor 1 plus 1, and of course up to a certain scaling factor, which because they are proportional. Okay? So that's what it says. Now, the going back to the previous interpretation, this is when you take the unit ball, that's your convex set. Okay? Okay, now here it's a remark is about the dependence, which I write in terms of inverse function, which means M expressed in terms of the huge space and the epsilon. And what is, it's better known than but something like the variance, the variant that we will be using gives this dependence. So first of all, it's logarithm of the huge space, and the dependence on epsilon is epsilon squared. Now, the dependence for like moderate values of epsilon in Dvoretsky theorem, like epsilon to 1/2, let's say, that's fairly well understood. That's pretty much, however, dependence on epsilon is not completely well understood. In fact, this is not the optimal statement depending on the exact question one asks, what happens here is that actually this is true even for a typical m-dimensional subspace. If you are asking just for existence, that would be a slightly different result. But there are still those things that are very far from being completely understood as far as dependence of epsilon goes.
Typical? I mean, better.
I think it's known with linear dependence on epsilon. Maybe modulo some logarithm things. If you don't insist on the typical, and actually this assumption really is that it's logarithm 1 over epsilon. Which is the case in some cases one can prove. For example, for L infinity, which is the extreme case for logarithm. Okay, so now that's the previous version was a little bit there exists, blah, blah, blah. But there is a version which was proved by Vitaly Milman, like maybe 70, 71. Another proof, started calling tangible version, which means that you get an inequality with parameters that are sort of something you can put your hand on. So now what's the situation? You have your n-dimensional Euclidean space, real or complex. So, you have Euclidean norm and some other norm, okay? And now what you are assuming that is that you have this inequality between the two norms. So this is this value B has two meanings. One is this is the maximum of the other norm over the Euclidean sphere. And another meaning is that this is the Lipschitz constant of this norm with respect to the Euclidean distance. So it's all the same number. Now, M is the average of the norm over the sphere. Okay? So now we have this ugly-looking number, and the theorem tells us that if we choose an M which is not too large, then a typical m-dimensional subspace of our original space is going to verify this two-sided estimate for every point in that subspace. So this means that up to this scaling factor, which happens to be the same as the expectation, with the average, the two norms are up to 1 plus epsilon, 1 minus epsilon equivalent. Okay? So now a few some comments. So now this is, of course, always smaller than one because average is less than maximum. And the content of Dvoretsky theorem, to retrieve the usual Dvoretsky theorem, one has to show that there is at least a tiny gain, that this thing in the parentheses is at least square root of log n over n. And that takes some work, but it's not very difficult. It's basically roughly the same thing that the worst case is the infinity norm, and its average is over this sphere is exactly that number. Okay, and now what happens is that there is a similar statement if you just have a Lipschitz function. So this means you have a Lipschitz function and some Lipschitz constant. You are going to have a similar statement. It has to state it differently. I will give actually a statement for Lipschitz functions later on, but it's basically the same. When you reduce that statement to two norms, this is what you get. Okay. So Dvoretsky theorem for certain classes. So this slide will contain basically a proof of the theorem of Haydn and Winter about Pirani entropy. Of course, modulo few black boxes and knowing what to look for, right? So first of all, so we are going to use just an instance of the Dvoretsky theorem that I stated on the previous slide, with in the Schatten class this Q, which is 2p, which is just bigger than arbitrarily bigger than 2. Then I'm going to use this k equals 2d, so this means that I'm going to work with really square matrices. Okay? So you have a square matrices, k by d. And then I'm going to look for subspaces which will come out from the formula, of the size that come out from the formula. But for epsilon, I'm not going to use anything small. I'm just going to use 1/2 so that I have a universal estimate. So that's 1 plus epsilon, 3 over 2 on the right, 1 over 2 on the left. Actually, I don't care about what's on the left. Okay, so now there are the two parameters, B and M, which in any concrete case, morally, are computable, right? For a natural norm, you can just calculate. And in the case of the Schatten norm, those are the values of the parameters. So B is, of course, 1. This is just a triviality because the Q's norm, if P is greater than 2, is smaller than the Hilbert-Schmidt norm. And this has to be justified. So I will justify it on the next slide. But it's not really complicated. Okay, so once we have this, we just substitute, right? So we have this formula for M, right? So B is 1, so it disappears. We have square matrices, so the dimension of the space in which we're working is D square. So this is M squared D. So then I am substituting what M is. So here into the parentheses, square out. Simplify, I get d to the power 1 plus over q, which is the same thing as d to the power 1 plus 1 over p. And now the sanity check is that if p equals 1, which means q equals 2, which means that I'm in the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, I'm getting d squared, not surprisingly. And in the case when p equals infinity, I'm getting d, which is also not very surprising, but less so. Okay, but in any case, this has been known basically in 77 in the paper by Figel, Inversions, and Milman. Now this statement isn't implicit in the paper, but it's isn't explicit, but it's implicit. So let's recapitulate it. What we get is that for a space of that dimension, we get those two-sided inequalities, and actually I simplify them. Because on the right-hand side, I have the M, right? This is what I had on the right-hand side. Remember, I had M times 1 plus epsilon, right? So I just take 1 plus epsilon is just 3 over 2, so I absorb it into a constant. And then I have another constant because, M is only roughly up to numerical constant, that thing, but so there is some constant, not very large, actually. And actually, that constant maybe even goes to 1 as p goes to 1. Okay? And the left side inequality is just a trivial inequality, which is valid universally between the Q's norm and the second norm. And I don't need to read Dvoretsky's theorem because it just happens that the average of the norm is within a constant from the minimum. So I'm not gaining anything just by using the 1 minus epsilon estimate, or not much at least, since I don't care about the constants. Okay? So I get this inequality. So now I know I can do the complete calculation. Everything is an open book. So the norm of my channel, random channel associated with my subspace, in that case, is going to be just this constant squared. The ratio of those norms, so this is this constant, squared. Right? So, well, I'm substituting, and that's the estimate I'm getting, right? There is no rocket science here. And now the important point is that, first of all, this is small because p is greater than 1. And also, it's as almost as small as it can conceivably be, right? Because I always have, for everywhere, I have this lower bound, right? So no matter what I do, I cannot jump over, I cannot get anything that is smaller than this for any channel whatsoever. So I am within a universal constant, which actually is a rather small constant. In fact, I am getting very close to the minimum. So this means that if I take two channels of this nature, right, and I tensor them, and I can show that there is anything not trivial happening for the product channel, I am done. And this is not, of course, not well, very simple, but once you know what you are looking for, so this was, I think, probably the notice by, I don't know, by Andreas, maybe, first, that when you take the channel with, when you tensor it with the conjugate channel, then you have this, this was shown, this was went over, I think, Fernando went over that in some detail, so in this case, this is what you get, because D equals to K, and M is the dimension, which is where? Here. It's here. So I'm using this multiplication. So now you see that this is the same as there. So what you get, this is up to a constant. Here and here, those are the same things. So this means that for the product channel, you have the same value as for each of the channels. And of course, those are small numbers. So this is the maximal possible violation that may happen. Okay, so that's the end of the proof, and that somehow this fits very nicely with this Voretsky theorem. It's just an appropriate instance, of course, once you figure out what to do, and so this is basically a dictionary and a block box. So now, just a little bit about justifying why we have this. The average equals to d to that power, whatever. So that's actually very simple because basically if you choose q equals infinity, then the average of the norm over the Hilbert-Schmidt ball is approximately 2 times 2 to the power minus 1/2. And now 2 is basically from the same as the Wigner semicircular law. Actually, to be completely exact in the this is the Marchenko-Pastor square case. This is like a quarter circle law, but it's the same 2, right? And then this is just a change of normalization. Because there is a standard formula which relates averages on the sphere to Gaussian averages. It's just equality with some gamma functions, and that's what it is, right? And this is the normalization, because we normalize the matrix in the Frobenius norm and in the Wigner semicircle law or Marchenko-Pastor normalization, it's a different normalization by basically you normalize columns. Okay, so that's for q equals infinity. Now, obviously, for the second norm is 1, and then you just hold the inequality to get an estimate in between, and you see that this is the only say constant that will appear is just the power of the 2, which actually will go to 0 as q approaches 2. Okay, so and since we actually one doesn't really have to refer to any of that, because it's if one wants to produce an elementary argument, it's simple to produce an elementary argument, because we don't even care about the constants. Like a standard epsilon argument also gives an estimate with some constant, not necessarily true. Okay, so now the counterexample to additivity. And I'm going to say just very little about it because, first of all, lots of the stuff was, I will just rush through the slides. Lots of the framework was already explained by, particularly by Fernando, and we are just following them, except that whenever we get into a hard calculation, then we say, well, let's just apply Gorecki theorem. And this happens twice in the argument. So that's basically okay. So the first fact was the inequality, which is really totally elementary, because this is the von Neumann entropy, but this is really commutative case because we have just one thing, one sigma, and so you just write what it means, and it's an inequality between logarithms. So well, anyway, Fernando showed the proof of that. And then when you take the minimum over all input states, or then you have to change again to maximum because it's a negative sign, then you get the lower bound for the output of the, okay, so that's the inequality. This is exactly the same inequality as Fernando had. So this is the entropy. This is just the same number, right? And here you just take maximum, right? So this does, so this reduces the study of the von Neumann entropy, right? Well, I mean, to mean output entropy, somehow to working really with Hilbert, with Euclidean distance, which of course it's simpler for a number of reasons. Well, so that's okay. So now the second fact, which also Fernando states, so basically it says that actually yes, we can do that, right? So going back here, we need to maximize such things. Just want to lower bound the minimum output entropy. So we can do that. It says this is the bound that we are getting, and I am stating in the form of matrices. So you have matrices varies over a subspace of Hilbert sheaf norm 1, and then you can, for the appropriate choice of parameters, that's the estimate what you get. And here now this is not going to be, well, this is what everybody was explaining. Somehow for this argument, it seems that it's somehow most nicely to take, d and k equals d square, and also m, or maybe not equal, but roughly. And also the size of the subspace is also of order of d square, and which is the same as k. So you look at the rectangular matrices, and then you take a subspace which are about the same dimension as the longer side, right? And in that case, that's what you get. So what I want to say now is that this is just recalling what. So now this is the rest of the proof, which was already went over twice today. So I will skip. So basically, the bottom line, somehow the hardest part. So now this part is the same large eigenvalue. Whenever you have whenever the dimension of your corresponding your channel is large, you have a large eigenvalue, and then you can somehow lower bound the upper bound, the output of the composite channel, and the hard part, technically hard part, is to find the minimum on that, which is based on that part. Okay. So now let's just focus exclusively on that inequality. So we have this inequality that we are looking at. So for matrices of norm 1, I want to have this inequality, right? And I square both sides so that I can now expand this. So this is just simple, whatever, I'm just writing what that is, right? So this is the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, I'm expanding, right? And so now, of course, I can calculate those traces. This is actually 1, because this is normalized in Hilbert-Schmidt norm. So everything that is simplifies, and I end up with trace of absolute value to the power 4 minus 1 over d, which of course is greater or equal than 0 because that's the trivial estimate between the norms, right? Okay, so now I'm getting from that, I'm deriving the following estimate, which is valid for all in the subspace. So now I'm writing this in the homogeneous form, right? So first, So I will explain how this works. So first, this inequality is just a trivial estimate, generally valid between the second and the fourth norm, and this is just a free phrasing of this norm. So if this is 1, then that is greater than b to minus 1 over 4, which is exactly that inequality. And then, when you look at this and this, when you compare those two things, then you get this second inequality. You just have to rearrange the things. You have to just move 1 over d to this side and take the fourth root, right? And that's what you get. Okay? So I get a two-sided estimate, and then I'm just using a very simple, this is just, first-order Taylor expansion of the fourth root. So what I get is I get a two-sided estimate. Hopefully that's on the next slide, right? Okay, I get a two-sided estimate for the fourth norm between this and that, and you notice that there is the common factor, scaling factor here, and they only differ by 1 plus this very small number. So in other words, what did I obtain? I obtained a subspace of the Schattenfors class, which is 1 plus of order 1 over d Euclidean. Okay? So that's an interpretation of this result. Now this is not, unfortunately, I cannot now just go, yes? Yeah, okay. Unfortunately, I cannot now go to the Dvoretsky theorem and say, well, so let's apply the Dvoretsky conference to Schattenfors class. If I do that, I will get only this, and this is exactly what also Fernando, I think, will say. Quite large gap between what the argument gives and what the standard proof gives and what is needed here, right? And what is true. Okay, so I have to skip quite a few slides if I have to go to the chaining argument actually. So the bottom line is that in order to prove this inequality here, basically one has to show that this function is small on a large subspace. Now this is done by applying Dvoretsky theorem twice. There is a bootstrap, and that's what Fernando explained, except that each of the steps is a one-time application of Dvoretsky inequality. Okay, and so maybe like about 30 seconds on this. So this first fact is what was on the talk of Fernando. So this means there is a set on which the Lipschitz constant of this function is much better than 2. Okay? And that set is a very large measure. Its complement is very small. And a typical m-dimensional subspace for the proper choice of m, which is like that, is whenever you intersect it with the unit sphere in the Frobenius norm, sits in that set. So this is given by one-time application of Dvoretsky theorem. And the rest things is based on, so this I will skip. The proof. Well, this was the proof of, and now this inequality is just Levy's lemma, which is here and which was also taken by Fernando. So whenever you have a Lipschitz function on a sphere, then it's highly concentrated about median, mean, or anything that is between the first and third quartile, for example. Right? So this is the central value. So that's pretty much anything that is close to median, it's true. And the point is, the key is that once you have concentration, then all those things are very close to each other. Right, if you have, this is what we need for the argument, so I get to show that norm is small on the subspace of A and B. Okay, now the final step is, The one trick which maybe I will mention is the following, which set up the stage for applying the Dvoretsky theorem, is that we have this function which has a very nice Lipschitz constant on this large subset omega. So now this is a very general fact that whenever you have a function on a subset of a metric space that is Lipschitz with a certain constant, you can extend it to the entire space preserving the Lipschitz constant. So what I do is I forget what the bad part of my function, I'm extending it to elliptic function to the entire system. And to this new function, I will be able to apply Bredsky theorem in the nonlinear form for Lipschitz functions, right? So this is, and since, as we had in the previous fact, for a typical subspace, this intersection sits in the set of omega, I can conclude the whatever I can prove for the modified function, I have also for the original function. Okay. So now, what is? There are two things that needed to be verified, because we want to know that we want to have a bound which is of order 1 over d. So we have to verify that first, the mean or median of this function is of order 1 over d, and right? And then the second thing is that if we have a deviation, epsilon, which is of this order, then we get the right value of m. And this just has to be verified, and it's not well, it takes a little bit of work, but it's not very difficult. Now, the key thing, so this is just restating the Dvoretsky theorem for Lipschitz functions, and there is some fine point here that, well, okay, I see I will not be able, I'm out of time almost. So the fine point here was that actually in this application it's needed in the complex case with this exact dependence on epsilon. And this is not, this was actually not available in the literature, but we found one of the proofs that worked in the real case that also was, could be carried over to the complex case, assuming that the function is circular, which means that we verify this condition. Okay, so this is like verifications, which is not, I will skip. And so maybe like, we might have 2 minutes about the chaining argument. So the standard proof of the Dvoretsky theorem go by the union bound, which means that you use Levy's lemma, and you know that since your Lipschitz function is heavily concentrated, if you pick an epsilon net in a subspace, and then you rotate that point randomly, with large probability you will be close to the median or to mean. Okay, now you do that for all points in the epsilon net using the union bound. Okay, and then you just approximate using that the function is Lipschitz, and you get what you needed. So now this randomness is given by the rotations, and in that subspace you are going to have your conclusion verified. Now, what happens is that this only gives this dependence on epsilon, and this is exactly what Jorge Fernando indicated. This is just exactly what is not sufficient. If you had anything that grows smaller than logarithm, it would work, but with logarithm it doesn't. So there is a chaining argument, and so here I'm going to say very quickly. So this is the following situation. So you have a metric space, compact metric space, and then you create, which has a radius, which means that it's containing a ball of radius R, and then you can create a hierarchy of nets. Each of them is resolution twice higher than the previous one. You start with R, and then R over 2, R over 4, and so forth. Okay? And now, for every point, with every point, we associate a point from the net which is closest to it, let's say. Okay? And then, if you have a continuous function on that metric space, then you can expand it in a telescoping series, where here you have evaluations in the respective approximations. Okay? So in particular, you can just use triangle inequality, and you can say that the difference between h of s and h of z is 0, which is this distinguished center, if you will, is less than the supremum over all maxima, where this point comes from the nk plus first net, and this point comes from nk's net. Okay? Now, the important thing here is that here, you are only, your points are only from the nets. They are no longer arbitrary. So this S is arbitrary, but those are points only from the net. So you get a way of visualizing your function by just using the nets. Okay? So now, if those are random variables, then this can be immediately rewritten in this form. Right? You just take expectation on both sides, and that's it. Okay? And now, surprisingly, this argument gives very sharp bounds for some, under some assumptions on the continuity of this process, here, which is indexed by S. Okay, so now So there is a what is called deadliest inequality, which tells you that exactly in the situation that we have before, if we know that the difference between our process is parameterized by T in our metric space, if we have Gaussian bounds on the tail, then we can find, we can write this estimate on the supremum of the process, and that's exactly what we are looking for, pretty much, right? We are looking. We want to show that this is small on large set. So if you find the expectation, also one can also get mean bounds. And this is just writing what I had on the previous slide. There is a slight work. Okay. So in our context, the parameter set is just the sphere in some fixed subspace plus the origin. Randomness is given by randomly rotating the subspace. Then the process is just this composition. And sub-Gaussian property is given by Levy's lemma. You just apply Levy's lemma in the smart way. This is a trick which is somewhat similar to what appeared in both talks this morning. And then one uses just elementary bound on the nets. Singularity at zero integrates out, and logarithm disappears. And that's it. Okay, and then, of course, there are some. That's all. Right, thank you. Well, of course, there is a... The obvious question is, can we find explicit maps that work in this case, or explicit subspaces? Now, this is, I think that's the current technology is not very far from getting this for the pure any entropy, but for, I think it's outside of the, behind the horizon for the von Neumann entropy.
My speaker sets up.
So this might be a question or a comment, depending on what you know about this. So this Dvoretsky theory is about almost Euclidean sections as subspaces of non-spaces.
Yes.
And this non-additivity example is an example where the tensor product of two such sections inside the tensor product of the two non-spaces is no longer approximately Euclidean.
Yes.
Right. So there are two possible.
But it's non-random, it's not typical, right?
Yes, yeah, that's true. But it's about the stability of the Euclidean spaces, of course, the tensor product of Euclidean spaces is Euclidean.
Depending on the norm, of course, depending on what the norm is,
Euclidean means it's a two norm. The tensor product.
The subspaces may be Euclidean, but in terms of them, depending how you take the tensor, what underlies there is in the talk by Margulis, there was the tensor product in a number of ways, and different things are natural in different contexts.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess we can thank the speaker again.